Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Well, thank you and good evening. It is really a pleasure to be here. I'm not sure that anyone ever turns down an opportunity to come to Santa Barbara. But I was particularly happy to come and speak for an event that was held by the CAP Center. And thank you very much to Clark and Leonard for setting this up and bringing me out here to do this. I had not only very much admired the work of the late Walter Capps, but I've really enjoyed the opportunity to talk with his wife, who was here earlier this evening. Occasionally, I get the chance to talk to members of the Democratic Caucus, usually on issues of religion and politics and how they intersect. And I will try not to caricature them too much to say that it's not out of bounds to hear from people questions like, "So you're telling us that some Democratic voters are religious?" So when I'm in a gathering that includes Congresswoman Capps, I always want to tell everybody else to leave so I can just talk to her. Because like her husband, she has such a smart, nuanced understanding of the issues that sit at the intersection of religion and politics. And it's one that I think allows her, as it does many people who really can grasp those issues, it allows her to branch beyond just straight partisan alliances and positions. I'm, in addition, very pleased to be giving the Martin Marty lecture. I was an aspiring sociologist for a little while, and someone who has read a lot of his work, both as a student and as a journalist. And I have to say that one of the thrills of my career so far was contacting him for an interview for my first book and doing the kind of insecure writerly thing of including a lot of information about what my book was going to be and who I was and why he really should talk to me, and I'd be very, 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 very grateful. And he wrote back immediately to say that he and his wife were fans of my work, which was fantastic. So I felt like I could just retire there. But I can't retire because there is too much to talk about in terms of religion and politics, and specifically in this campaign. Before I begin, though, I do want to acknowledge that there's always some danger when you mix religion and politics. One of my favorite political stories is from a few years ago when the state of South Dakota was going through a fairly serious drought. And the Republican governor of the state at the time did, as you would, what seemed to make sense in dealing with a drought. He declared a statewide day of prayer. And everybody in the state of South Dakota was going to pray on the same day for rain. You might remember that Rick Perry did this as well in Texas last summer when they had the really horrible droughts. And I'm not sure it was terribly successful then, so there might be a lesson in this. But in South Dakota, anyway, a few years ago, they had this statewide day of prayer, and everybody prayed for rain. And lo and behold, it started to rain the very next day. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained for 2 weeks in a row. It rained so much that the poor parched ground wasn't able to absorb the water. And so what happens then is you get floods. So they went from a drought to having floods and eventually had to call in FEMA to do some disaster work because there was so much rain that the state just couldn't handle it, which I think is a very good illustration of the warning that you should be careful what you pray for. There's also a danger for those of us who write and report about religion and politics. And I was reminded of this when I was looking back at some of the previous speakers who have given this lecture. I hadn't done that before I picked out the topic of the talk, and I had known that I wanted to talk about the culture wars. So I was a little chagrined when I took a look at past speakers and realized that my good friend and colleague E.J. Dion, who was here just 2 years ago, had given his talk on the subject of the end of the culture wars. Now, I hate to disagree with E.J., And I certainly don't want to pick on him, because I am far from the first person who should be casting a stone about bad political predictions. There was a column I wrote just this past December in which I believe I poked fun at the idea that Rick Santorum would ever last in the Republican primaries. I believe I referred sarcastically to the improbability of a come-from-way-behind Rick Santorum boomlet, and also mocked the idea that Newt Gingrich would stay in the primaries. So the fact that they were the last two, along with Mitt Romney, is certainly not testament to my powers of prediction. But I do want to refer back to EJ's talk, because I think there were, at the time, some fairly good reasons to suspect that maybe we were reaching a new era in terms of political discourse, that maybe it did make sense to think that people were tired of the culture wars and had found maybe new directions for their energies. And so I want to talk about how this kind of astonishingly quick reversal took place over the last few years, and to attempt an explanation for why that is. One of the points that EJ had made that I completely agree with is that cultural issues tend to recede when there are more important things on people's minds, things like economic uncertainty, issues like war. This was definitely what we saw in 2008. Often people like to scour the exit polls and have an idea of how different demographic groups voted. And one of the things that those of us who look at religion tend to do is figure out, how did Catholics vote? How did evangelicals vote? Well, setting aside the idea that it's a little absurd to think that Catholics, who are 25% of the electorate, vote in one way, in 2008, it was particularly absurd because Catholics didn't vote based on their understanding of Catholic social teaching. They voted as voters. They voted based on their ideas about the economy and which candidate they thought could better handle the economic challenges. And so in that election, EJ was very right to say that cultural issues really did recede into the background. And yet, 7 months out from the 2012 presidential election, here we are. We're listening to Rush Limbaugh talk about contraception and call college students sluts on the radio. We're listening to people claim that there is a war on religion or there's a war on women, competing kind of wars. And I would just interject here that whenever you hear language about a war, it's usually because that's very good for political fundraising. It's not so good for democratic discourse, however. And so I would like to talk about the particular culture war that has kind of cropped up in the last few months and give us some way of understanding where it's come from, what to think of it, and how this might play a role in this year's election. So the issue around which this current culture war is being waged is the issue of religious liberty. Now, I know that often it's thought of instead as an issue of contraception. Are there people who oppose contraception or want to limit access for contraception? Sometimes it's characterized as issues about women and women's rights. And those are certainly taking place as well. But the larger issue is one of religious liberty and different conceptions of what that means, particularly in a pluralistic country like ours. And this is an issue that I have to let you know has been in the works for a long while, not just in the sense that the founders of our country were concerned about religious liberty and argued about it themselves quite a bit, but this has been something particularly in conservative circles that has... It's been discussed for at least the last decade or so, and that discussion has been almost a resurgence from the concerns that drove the creation of the moral majority and the religious right to begin with. That organization and that movement came out of a backlash against many different changes in the culture, but particularly some court decisions in the 1960s and 1970s that did things like take Bible reading and prayer out of public schools. A lot of conservatives see similar things happening these days. They see themselves on the defensive. And so they've been talking for a while about whether there's a war on religion, whether secularists are trying to push religion out of the public square and make it something that's not acceptable to discuss. This was also something that I think explains the Newt Gingrich candidacy and the fact that he had quite a lot of deal of support, particularly from religious conservatives this past year. Newt, when he decided he was going to get back into electoral politics, made religion and religious freedom kind of his signature issue. About 5 or 6 years ago, he put out a book, and he's always writing books, particularly historical fiction, interestingly enough. And I'm not being sarcastic. But he put out a book called Rediscovering God in America, in which he made the argument that secularism was taking over America and that the public square was less and less welcoming to religious people. When he talks about religious people, he tends to mean Christians and specifically conservative Christians. But nevertheless, that's kind of the argument that has been out there in conservative circles, and it's become a national debate this year as we've all followed it. Now, the specific issue around which this has come to the fore this year was around healthcare reform. So you'll recall that was something that Congress debated and passed 2 years ago. But it continues to be a fight that is battled over, even though the law was passed and signed. And the specific issue here was that health reform required a certain number of things be included in health insurance. Things that were considered preventive care. And this past summer, one of those things that needed to be covered was determined to be contraception. This was considered to be preventive care and something that, therefore, all employers had to provide to their employees. So employers had to make sure that the health plans they had in place for their employees included coverage for contraception, among other preventative care options. And this would be offered with little to no copay for the employees. So, in essence, this was expanding access to contraception for women across the U.S. And it actually resulted in the largest expansion of contraception access ever in American history. The estimate is that somewhere around 25 million women will now have access to contraception that they couldn't afford otherwise. So that was a fairly big deal. And it was something that was bound to concern Catholic employers. The Catholic Church runs a number of hospitals and universities in this country and therefore is an employer of quite a lot of people. And so, as with all issues that kind of galvanize people in the way that culture issues tend to, it does have its roots in legitimate concerns. Because Catholic dioceses, Catholic employers, did have some principles that they saw were at stake. Nobody who supports the idea of separation of church and state, so we may need to exempt Rick Santorum from that discussion. But nobody who considers religious liberty an important value wants government going in and telling religious organizations how they need to run themselves. That's just something that traditionally as a country we have decided was important to prevent against, because separation of church and state exists not only so that religion doesn't have an impact and shape the government, but also so that the government doesn't go in and shape how religious organizations are doing their own work. However, the way this all played out, and I'm sorry if I have to get into some wonky details here, but that's kind of what the debate has all been around, ended up being more on the level of politics than of principle. and that wasn't on both sides. Looking at the Democratic side first, one of the things that became clear when there started to be some pushback from Catholics about this proposed mandate for employers was that the women's groups who had really supported the expansion of contraception access believed that the only Catholics who would really have any problem with this had to be the Catholic bishops. Otherwise, if you were a thoughtful Catholic, of course you would be on board. Who would have a problem with this? And they kind of poo-pooed all of the concerns that were raised, not just by the Catholic bishops, but by moderate Catholics, who had traditionally been allies of the White House in passing health care reform. In fact, the women's groups immediately started contacting the White House and warning them not to give in to the bishops, and kind of set the whole debate so that it looked like this was a matter of women versus just the Catholic bishops, and that, you know, if you had a problem with it, you had a problem with women. But it wasn't just the bishops, although I think a lot of people in Democratic politics have decided over the past few years that Catholic bishops are a handy villain to kind of put out there. They weren't the only ones who are upset, though. We're talking about the nuns who made health reform possible with their support for it. People like Sister Carol Keehan, who runs the Catholic Health Association, was quite concerned about the initial mandate that was put out, because this is a woman who helps run all of the Catholic hospitals in the country, and knew that it was going to be a problem to go to the hospitals and say, you suddenly have to start including contraception coverage in the healthcare that you are providing for your employees. Senator Bob Casey, who's a Democrat from Pennsylvania, who's up for a pretty tight reelection race this year, also had told the White House that he was concerned about this, among other Catholic Democrats. People like E.J. Dionne and another of our colleagues, Melinda Hennenberger at the Washington Post, who's herself a Catholic, wrote about the fact that they were concerned the White House hadn't really thought through some of the issues here that concerned religious liberty. And they were right. As so often happens, particularly on the Democratic side of politics, this wasn't a matter of Democrats going after religion and deciding, wow, we're really going to stick it to the bishops on this one. It was more a matter of what usually happens. It just didn't even occur to them that there were religious liberty issues that would be affected. It just didn't occur to them to even think about it. And so, as so often happens, it was something that just didn't get factored into the proposal in the first place. So what happened, as many of you may have followed, is that the White House has been put in a position of revising, and then revising again, and now revising for a third time, their proposal in terms of how religious employers should be treated when it comes to this mandate. Because they understand, belatedly, but not completely late, that there are two different principles here that are sometimes in conflict. One is the principle of providing access to health care, and in this case, contraception coverage for women. And the other is the religious liberty claims by employers who don't want to use their own money to purchase something that they are morally opposed to. In this case, contraception, which the Catholic Church is officially opposed to. And I think many people who have followed this think that they've arrived at a pretty good place at this point. Just to spare you some of the wonky details, I'll try to go through this as quickly as possible. Basically, what they've said is you're exempt from this requirement if you're a house of worship, if you're a religious body like a diocese or an archdiocese. You're exempt if you're a religious employer. And who gets to decide who is religious are those religious bodies themselves. This is not a matter of the government going in and saying, you're a religious employer and you're not. Because that was something that had also given some people some upset stomachs thinking about government playing that role. And they've also kind of set in place a somewhat complicated but effective system that is intended to provide distance between employers and the actual provision of the insurance and the contraception coverage. Most people, including most of the moderate Catholics who were initially concerned about this, have decided that they've dealt with the reasonable concerns that were in place. But unfortunately, that hardly matters at this point, because Obama's political opponents, or at least some of them, had geared up for a fight over religious liberty. And so whether or not the White House has actually dealt with these concerns is kind of a side issue. The larger fight over religious liberty is what's going to take place this year, and what has already kind of defined a lot of the debate. And I think that has been clear, actually, since the beginning of President Obama's administration. It was something that caused some concern among some conservative Catholics that Obama got a majority of the Catholic vote in 2008. That in itself is not a surprise. Every winning presidential candidate for the past 40 years has ended up winning a majority of the Catholic vote. But still, it was something that caused some alarm among Republicans and among some conservative Catholics. And it was one of the reasons that when he was invited to speak at Notre Dame's commencement in 2009, there was quite a loud protest among some alumni, certainly among some Catholic leaders who tried to pressure the university into withdrawing their invitation to the president. And he ended up showing up and being able to give the commencement address at the university, but it continued to kind of fester as an issue around which you were likely to hear some Catholic protests. In addition, in the very first month of the Obama administration, the Catholic Church put together kind of an unprecedented campaign. I don't remember seeing this before, to whip up opposition to a piece of legislation that actually still has not been introduced in Congress. This doesn't usually happen. Usually there's something already in place, like, say, a proposal for healthcare reform, and then you kind of gather people to lobby against it. In this case, the church was lobbying against a bill called the Freedom... Oh, now I'm going to forget what it stands for. FOCA. Well, it's a pro-choice bill, that's what I can tell you. It has actually not been introduced, but the church was very concerned because Obama had made a campaign pledge that this was something he would do, is sign this bill if introduced. And there were postcard campaigns in every parish for Catholics to contact the White House and express their opposition to this. Now, I have to say, EJ did give his talk after these things had already happened, and I'm going to let him slide on that a little bit. I think he's more likely to give his church the benefit of the doubt. But even though my last name is Sullivan, I am not a Catholic, as EJ is. I'm an evangelical and a Baptist, so I get to be a little less measured in my take on the Catholic Church and their political involvement. So I can tell you that by last fall, it had become pretty clear that this was going to be the issue for the bishops in this election year, the issue of religious freedom and the idea that the Obama administration in particular had singled out the Catholic Church and was targeting the Catholic Church and its policies. In fact, you didn't really have to read that into what was going on. The bishops hold an annual meeting every fall in Baltimore. And this past year, they declared that there wasn't really time to talk about any other substantive issue other than religious freedom. That was the only issue that was up for discussion among the bishops, which is unusual because the bishops actually are very involved, particularly in the level of lobbying within Washington on things like the economy and pushing for more comprehensive immigration reform. It's not just that the scope of their interest is very narrow, and that this year they've declared that religious freedom is the issue to focus on and nothing else. So now we actually are in the situation that the women's groups thought we were last fall, in which the bishops are the only ones left who are unsatisfied with the White House's approach to contraception access and to this employer mandate. They have called for a campaign for religious liberty. There was a call a couple of weeks ago for a day of prayer to pray about the attacks that the church saw itself as under. And yet, the bishops, again, in an unusual move, have had nothing to say about the Republican budget, which the House just passed. And I have to stress again how unusual this is. Usually, when a proposal that includes fairly severe cuts in either domestic aid or foreign aid in particular, the bishops are out within 48 hours with a statement protesting this and warning about the dire effects of slashing aid. And in fact, this is something that they kind of preemptively approach Congress with through letters saying these are the issues that we think need to be protected and thought about when you're putting together a budget. And essentially, this may be a little too glib, but if you were to put the issues letter from the bishops next to Paul Ryan's budget, they would basically be opposite in terms of the issues that the bishops say need to be protected and the programs that have been cut in the Republican budget. So this is something that the bishops usually are very vocal on and big players in terms of speaking out and speaking up about protecting programs. But again, they've had nothing to say, and in part it's because of a desire to prevent the focus from being distracted and to keep everything on the issue of religious liberty. So you may be wondering, are they just out in a field by themselves on this issue, or is there support among American voters to focus, particularly in this election year, on religious liberty? Well, there's one polling firm in particular, which is called the Public Religion Research Institute, that's done some careful polling on this, and I think they've gotten to the meat of it better than anybody else has. And what they found is that there's near universal support among Americans for the principle of religious liberty. When people are asked if they agree with the statement that America was founded on the idea of religious freedom for everyone, including unpopular religious groups, 9 out of 10 Americans agree with that. But a majority of Americans, and that includes a majority of Catholic Americans, do not think that religious liberty is threatened today. When they're asked about something like this contraception mandate, they agree that there should be an exception made for houses of worship, that churches and pastors and a diocese should not need or not be forced to pay for something or provide something that they disagree with. But after that, they very much support the idea of the contraception mandate and think that that principle trumps the religious liberty concerns of, say, a Catholic university that may have many students who are not Catholic, or a private employer who happens to be Catholic. Those aren't things that Americans in general believe should be seen as exceptions. And yet, last week in Wisconsin on the campaign trail, Mitt Romney kind of doubled down on this issue and declared that there is a war on religion in America and said, quote, that there's a desire to establish in religion a religion in America known as secularism. As I mentioned earlier, Newt Gingrich has been out there before Mitt Romney, certainly, and maybe before a lot of his Republican colleagues. And he has been a little more dramatic, as is his wont, when it comes to these things, calling the contraception mandate, quote, the greatest assault on religious liberty in American history. Now, I've been a little surprised by that comment, given that Speaker Gingrich is a history professor, or at least was in his previous life before he became a politician, and would think that perhaps a historian would remember things like the Oregon Law in 1922, which made it a crime to attend a Catholic school. Or maybe even Mitt Romney could give him a little bit of education on the trail about the time when the President of the United States sent the U.S. Army out to Utah to suppress the growing Mormon population out there, which Romney might define as an assault on religious liberty as well. In fact, for each of the pieces of evidence that are kind of held up to form the case that there's a war on religion or a war on religious liberty, I think it's possible to find one that proves the opposite. And honestly, that's not really unusual. You often have political administrations that are doing things through various federal agencies that aren't always consistent. In fact, it would be amazing and shocking if they were consistent across the administration. This is one of the reasons why it's particularly maddening to hear people talk about things like a war on religion or a war on women, because very often, most often, there's absolutely no coordination to any of this. It's a matter of taking kind of separate policy decisions or developments over here and this over there, and stringing them together to pretend that this was some concerted effort. Again, it would be amazing if politicians were capable of doing that. But it would also be incredibly surprising. Usually these are disparate events that get thrown together under the umbrella of a concerted campaign. So you could, on the one hand, take the fight over the contraception mandate and say, you know, the White House did not seem to be particularly responsive to concerns from religious groups. They didn't seem to take seriously the Catholics who were contacting them to say, you know, we're not very comfortable with this. But then at the same time, you'd have to look at the fight that hasn't happened over religion in the Obama administration. Both conservatives and liberals, I think it's safe to say, assumed that when Obama took office in January 2009, that one of the first things he would do would be to disband the faith-based initiative that George W. Bush created and put in place. Instead, what Obama did is expand the faith-based initiative and create an advisory council of faith leaders who have reported to him on the various policies that are included in the faith initiative rubric, but also on what can be done to reform the faith-based office and the faith-based initiative and make it more of an effective government program. Several conservative leaders before the 2008 election, religious conservative leaders, had actually told me that they kind of hoped that Obama would get rid of the faith-based initiative because that would provide such an easy fight. And you can almost hear the talking points if he had done away with it, that you're kicking religious people out of government, taking away their rights and their funds. This was something that was part of the government, and now, you know, Obama had taken it away. Instead, the faith-based offices at government agencies are more active than they were even under George W. Bush. And the most controversial aspect of the policy, which was a decision that Bush made to allow religious employers to discriminate in their hiring, so to decide that everybody they hired had to be from the same faith background if they wanted to, even if they were receiving government funds, this has been allowed to remain, and it's something that has really upset a lot of Obama's liberal supporters, because they assumed for sure, even if he kept the faith-based initiative, that was something that he would have done away with. The funds that have gone to religiously affiliated organizations have also increased in number during Obama's term, with Catholic organizations getting more than $1.5 billion in federal funds over the past 2 years. So from a numbers point of view, it gets a little harder to make the case of a war on religion or a war on the Catholic Church when you look at something like this. To take another example, there's been a charge, and Rick Santorum was particularly fond of repeating this on the campaign trail, that Barack Obama has stopped talking about the freedom of religion And instead, he has replaced that phrase in speeches with freedom of worship. And to understand why that matters, you'd have to understand that the concern here is that freedom of worship as a concept is much narrower, that it protects the ability of people to assemble and to worship together, but not necessarily their rights as religious people. And that would, in fact, be reason for concern if that's what was taking place. And the idea is that Obama was limiting religious freedom in order to be able to open up space to step in and tell religious institutions what to do. As I mentioned earlier about the concern with the government and the court stepping in and saying that Bible reading and prayer had to go out of public schools, this was kind of on the same level of concern among a lot of religious conservatives. Fortunately, all you really have to do is log onto whitehouse.gov and run a search on the site to be able to answer this question about whether Barack Obama has replaced one phrase with the other. And it turns out, if you do this, as I have, Obama has used the phrase freedom of religion more than 125 times in the last 3 years. And he's talked about freedom of worship only 9 times. If you compare that to the years of George W. Bush, he often used the two, as many people do, interchangeably. And he spoke of freedom of worship dozens of times during his time as president. Not more than he did freedom of religion, but enough to definitely swamp the instances under Obama. In fact, in 2008, Bush issued a proclamation to declare a religious freedom day, and it contained the phrase freedom of worship 3 separate times in just a 1-paragraph proclamation. And I would argue that nobody is going to charge George W. Bush with waging a war on religion. Another example that both the Catholic bishops and other religious conservatives have brought up in this new culture war over religious liberty is a decision by Obama's Health and Human Services agency not to renew a grant to an organization that was run by the Catholic bishops. This specific grant was for work with refugees who had been involved in sex trafficking, and it ended up being given to 2 other organizations because the Catholic group does not refer refugees for contraception or abortion services. Now, you can argue about whether those should be important services for these particular refugees, but that was among the criteria for grant recipients, that they needed to provide these services. And so HHS opted not to renew the grant for this Catholic organization. The Catholic bishops has seized on this as part of a concerted effort to go after the church in what they and other commentators have called a war on Catholics. But at the same time, they have largely ignored what's happened over at another federal agency. The U.S. Agency for International Development, which is referred to often as USAID, has issued a directive banning just that sort of factoring when making grant decisions. They would ban discrimination against faith-based and other organizations that decide not to engage in activities such as condom distribution that they feel violate their religious or moral principles. So in other words, while one federal agency has the practice of factoring this into their decision-making, another federal agency has made the decision not to do that, to kind of be religion-blind or values-blind when they're making grant determinations. But rather than develop or see this development as evidence that there is no war on Catholics, the bishop's top advisor on abortion issues and other pro-life issues basically shrugged in response to this development and said that he didn't think it really amounted to much because the directive was limited to just some programs funded by one federal agency. And you remember, the bishops launched this campaign on behalf of religious freedom last fall because of one decision by one agency. So there's a bit of inconsistency here, let's put it that way. And finally, it's continues to be hard to take this issue of religious liberty, which is grounded in very real concerns about real principles. It's hard to take it seriously when you realize that there was no concern among religious conservatives for most of the Bush administration over the fact that Bush had not tightened rules, which many religious conservatives wanted, to provide conscience exceptions for healthcare workers who didn't want to do things like distribute contraception if they were pharmacists, or take part in abortion procedures if they were nurses or other medical assistants. Bush actually didn't change those rules until the last month that he was in office. But it wasn't because of pressure from religious conservatives or a concern about a war on religious freedom. Mitt Romney's involvement in health reform in Massachusetts actually involved far fewer protections for religious conscience among healthcare workers and indeed among the mandate to provide contraception than the national health reform that went through on Obama's watch. But I'm betting he won't be mentioning that on the campaign trail this year. And in fact, there has been nothing much said about the fact that Newt Gingrich and others have supported laws to ban the use of Sharia law, which we can get into during questions, but essentially is a set of Muslim principles, that are sometimes referred to in civil court cases. This has also happened, by the way, with religious Jewish law, sometimes canon law. So it's not just Muslim law that can be appealed to in civil cases. But the bans that have been proposed at different state levels have focused specifically on Sharia. But nobody has been terribly concerned about what that means for the religious freedom of Muslims in America. One of the other developments that EJ had pointed to 2 years ago to make his case that he thought we were coming to the end of the culture war era was an increased sensitivity among Democrats to issues of religion and to religious voters. This was the topic of my book, was how Democrats had kind of found themselves somewhat alienated from some religious voters and certainly not as conversant and sensitive to religious issues as Republicans had become, partly for political reasons, but partly because they were just more in tuned with the concerns of a lot of religious groups. That had changed over the course of the last decade. And unfortunately, I think we're starting to see some backsliding among Democrats. One of the calculations that the Obama White House made with this contraception mandate that has been debated this year was that they could take the risk of annoying religious groups if they were doing something that made women happy. So, in other words, making the calculation that it was more important to court female voters than religious voters who might care about this issue. And in fact, they may well have been right on this particular issue. But if that's all they focus on, they will have taken the wrong lesson from this particular debate. Because Americans still continue to be extremely religious. It's been a pretty consistent finding in public opinion polls for the last 40 years, that about 85% of Americans say religion is an important part of their lives. Now, that doesn't mean that Americans are going to vote against Barack Obama because of this specific contraception mandate, but it does mean that you can't afford to look as if you are either hostile to or uninterested in the concerns of religious Americans. Obama continues to give some very smart talks when it's just him talking about religion. He held a Easter breakfast, which he's been doing the last few years, last week at the White House for some Christian leaders. And he talked, as he has over the past few years, very candidly about his faith, about his belief in Christ and the resurrection, things that maybe they should consider making commercials out of if a large number of Americans continue to believe he's Muslim. But in language that is so steeped in religiosity that I think it would have really concerned people if it was coming out of the mouth of George W. Bush. In fact, a lot of Obama's language when he talks about religion has been much more explicitly religious than anything Bush ever said when he was in the White House. And so that's been interesting to see that the president has continued to put an emphasis on that. However, the follow-through in giving the message to his political and policy aides that they need to be concerned about religious issues has not been there. And that's where I think the White House is vulnerable and is one reason why they found themselves in this position. A lot of Democrats in D.C., as I mentioned earlier, think of the Catholic bishops as political opponents and nothing else. And they have rarely recognized when there is opposition to something they're doing from larger circles of Catholics or from other religious communities. And I think that's really a blind spot that is not unusual given the history of the recent Democratic Party, but does represent, again, some backsliding from where the party had come in the last few years. So if the culture wars are back, are they the same culture wars that we've been familiar with since the 1980s on? Definitely not. And there, I think EJ is right to see the start of a new era. There are definitely some differences to this current round. And I'm tempted, since my husband and I just hosted our first Seder at our home this past weekend, to frame it by asking, how is this culture war different from all other culture wars? First, this isn't just a matter of religious conservatives on one side and liberal secularists on the other, which is basically how things fell out for much of the past three decades. The era of the religious right succeeded in doing a lot of things, but one of those was alienating a lot of people from the idea of religion or Christianity. Definitely evangelicalism. I can tell you, as somebody who publicly identifies myself as an evangelical, the horror on people's faces tells me they see that as a political label, not a theological label. But over the past 6 or 8 years, one of the really interesting developments, and the one I try to spend a lot of my time reporting on, has been the emergence of new religious voices. So people who don't fall into the camp of religious right supporters, but they also can't be called liberal secularists. Right now in D.C., in fact today and tomorrow, there's a meeting called the Q Conference, which is largely for younger Christians and younger evangelicals specifically. It's called Q to stand for questions. And it's something that's taken place for the last few years, driven by some younger evangelical ministers who want to get beyond the idea that evangelicals should only care about kind of hot-button social issues. These are evangelicals who want to talk about things like sex trafficking, the environment, disarmament, who are interested in a range of issues and for whom neither political party really fits them well. I think they are in a position to be able to really challenge both political parties because they are not obvious voters for either one. And if they can figure out a political way to exert their influence, may be in a position to really be interesting voices in our political discourse. Another development has been the emergence of young Catholics who are not only pushing back against the idea of who can be a good Catholic, but who are media savvy, which is not something that has ever been said about religious liberals in the past. And I just want to give you a few examples of what they've been doing because it hasn't gotten a lot of coverage. And I think it's really telling of kind of a debate that's taking place inside Catholic communities these days. If you'll remember, in 2004, John Kerry got charged a lot with being a bad Catholic because of his support for abortion rights. And there weren't a lot of Catholics standing up at the time to defend him and to say, well, that's kind of a narrow way to define whether you're a good Catholic or not. This group called Catholics United started up right after the 2004 campaign because they saw this vacuum out there in terms of Catholic voices. One of the things they did in the past year was approach Paul Ryan, the House budget chairman, who was speaking at a conference that Ralph Reed put together. And they have this on video, so you can look it up on YouTube because it's pretty interesting to watch. I don't think I've ever seen a Republican in this position before. So they approached him very politely with a Bible. The guy said, you know, I'm a Catholic too, and I just wanted to suggest that you spend a little more time reading this and a little less time reading Ayn Rand, whom Paul Ryan has declared is a big, big philosophical influence on him. And to watch Paul Ryan just scurry as fast as his little legs can take him to the SUV waiting to take him away, again, is something I haven't seen, I don't think, ever. The same group approached Rick Santorum when he was giving a talk and asked him afterwards to give his thoughts to them about Catholic social teaching and the preferential option for the poor, which is an important idea in Catholic social teaching, the idea that in whatever you do, whether it's in the private sector or whether it's government, you need to think first about how it's going to affect the most vulnerable among you. And Rick Santorum genuinely had not heard of the preferential option for the poor, which is not something necessarily to criticize him for. It's just fascinating and something that told you that his Catholicism was maybe out of the mainstream of what we have known of Catholic social teaching and the understanding. They also, during the Occupy Wall Street protests, built a golden calf, which looks like the bull from Wall Street, and took it to the protests. They've also staked out John Boehner's office with it on a couple of occasions. And it was immediately a way for them to connect to even secular Americans who knew the story of the golden calf and knew in an image what that means, that you're putting money above all else. And it was such a brilliant visual that it ended up on the front page of the Washington Post, which, again, is not something that religious liberals have been doing for a while. So it will be up to people in my profession this year and going forward to notice things like this and to pay attention to them and to give them coverage instead of doing what we often do, which is reverting to the very easy characterization of debates as a fight between religious people on one side and secularists on the other. That's far too facile a frame here. And it really misses a lot of the interesting debates that are going on within some communities. I'll just, instead of going through all of those, close by noting that there are already some signs that Republicans are starting to recognize that maybe this isn't the best focus for an election year. Already they've pulled back from the attacks on contraception coverage. There was for a little while a flurry of bills at the state level taken even further, saying that employers should be able to know whether their employees are using contraception. I believe that one was in Arizona. It becomes a little easier to call something a war on women when they're including something like that. But the result has been a fairly significant drop in support among women for Mitt Romney when polls pair him up with Obama to see how they do in the fall. And Republicans are starting to really worry about that. They were already worried about the fact that Hispanic support for the Republican Party has been low and not rising at all, given the statements about immigration that have come up during the Republican primaries. As well, the anti-Sharia laws that were being kind of pushed through various state legislatures last year have also kind of disappeared, which I think is an indication that there's been backlash. And maybe they need to bring back compassionate conservatism, because that was a little better for the party brand. But this isn't just about a culture war, because if it was, I wouldn't be here talking about it. It's about larger principles that are at stake in this country. Questions like whether the country does have an interest in promoting things like contraception use and trying to lower abortion rates. Just today, the numbers came out showing that we are right now at the lowest level of teen pregnancies in the last 70 years, which is partly a combination of kids having less sex and, when they're having sex, using contraception. So there are real results from things like this. There are important questions like whether there are limits to religious liberty. The bishops have kind of implied that religious liberty is an absolute right that cannot be restricted. But if you follow that out, you end up at the same argument which was used by segregationists to defend separating races. If you follow it out, you would end up at a point where you would allow polygamy if it could be defended on religious grounds. And you arrive at a point where you have competing religious freedom claims that can't be reconciled. So we need to talk about these questions as a society. We are a pluralistic society, and we are going to remain one. And that means that there is always a continuing need to figure out these balances and figure out how they work in different contexts. But we'll have more productive discussions, and maybe even a chance of reaching agreement, only if we can put down our arms first and stop talking about war. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.